I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Nancy Lechuga.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, we have a kind of special show. We were able to do two short interviews with two fantastic poets, Cheryl Luna and Nikki Saun Schildkraut. Both of them have just come out with new books, and both of them are going to be on the show. It's a special treat for Words on a Wire. So stick around, and we'll talk to them. Yesterday, I went into Juarez, and it was a lot of fun. I took a bunch of pictures, and it's just a great place to live that you can cross the border and suddenly you're in, you know, a completely different landscape. And El Paso and Juarez have a lot of similarities. You grew up here. You grew up in the Segundo Barrio.
Yes, it's very inspirational. And I actually was going to tell you about those great photographs that you took. There was this photograph that you took, and it was very interesting because there was this this project that was done here in El Paso where they took photographs of just people, faces of the border. And they were pasted all over town here in El Paso and in Juarez. And you took a very, I thought it was a very symbolic picture because these pictures were taken a little bit more than a year ago. So there were these big photographs that were pasted on the walls.
Big giant faces.
Big giant,
yeah,
yes.
You can see this if you look at my Facebook page. It's called An Afternoon in Juarez. It's an album, and yeah, it's the very first picture.
Yeah, so they were fading out, and you know they're torn pictures of you know this thing that was a year ago, and on top of them there were these smaller photographs of actual missing people.
Right.
So I thought it was so symbolic of El Paso and Juarez, and just
especially Juarez. It's really sad because there's a lot of young women that are still missing, and so
yes.
These parents will put their pictures, the pictures of their daughters, all over town and say "Se busca," and they'll give the name and a picture. And so in these huge pictures of ordinary people that have started to peel away, people had put posters of their missing daughters, and in one of them they put a poster where an eye should be, and another one put a poster where the other's eye should be. So it's like this big picture with two eyes of missing young women. Yeah, it's very sad.
It's definitely a different experience, I think, being a writer here in the border.
Yeah.
You know, we have certain conversations. I was having a conversation with a friend recently about just random acts of violence that we have experienced, you know, going to Juarez or even heard from other people. And I noticed how that's kind of exclusive. It's not exclusive of the border because these things happen all over the world. But it's very interesting that this is part of our daily conversation.
Right.
You know, still they say that the violence has gone down a bit, but it's still very much part of the dialogue. And it still very much influences us as writers. And it's definitely very special to be part of this very unique culture that we have here on the border.
You know, Rigoberto Gonzalez, the Chicano writer, says in an essay that most Chicano writers come from either Fresno or El Paso. And I think in Fresno, I remember when I went back there as a visiting professor a couple of years ago in the MFA program and at Fresno State, I was the visiting professor. I remember walking to class my first day and overhearing the conversation of these two young women, and they were saying, "Did you go to that party last night?" And the other one goes, "No, I went to the one where the guy was shot." And she goes, "Oh, I didn't go to that one."
Yeah.
It was just
that's
casual.
Yeah,
Fresno has its violence too. But let's not talk too much about violence. Let's talk about poetry. We have Cheryl Luna, doubleheader today. Cheryl Luna, author of 7 beautiful book of poems, and Nikki Saun Schildkraut, whose book, Magnetic Refrain, is also very beautiful, and we're very honored to have them both on the show. So stick around.
Nikki Saun Schildkraut is a writer and teacher who lives in Los Angeles. As a Korean adoptee, Her creative and scholarly work reflects an ongoing interest in exploring the emotional and historical aspects of the Korean diaspora, as well as transnational adoption. She has also collaborated on avant-garde music and art projects with composers and visual artists. She holds an MFA degree in poetry from the University of Florida and a PhD degree in literature and creative writing from the University of Southern California. She is currently completing a second book of lyrical and narrative poems inspired by cinema and a nonfiction book about transnational adoption narratives. Welcome, Nikki, to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're very glad to have you. We're both holding your book, Magnetic Refrain, which is, I think, a lovely book. I heard of it, of course, was we did a reading together in Harvard Square with Lee Herrick, who organized it. And you read from this book, and it was lovely. But having the chance to really go through it, I'm learning something about you as a poet. You're kind of, how shall I say it, fierce. Your poems are really, they get to the jugular. They're fierce. That's a good way to put it. Have you always been so fierce as a poet?
That's a good question. I guess I don't think of myself as fierce, but I guess I sort of was trying to answer that question of writing pretty subjects, I think, is something that a lot of poets start out writing about.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say when we first write poetry, especially, we write about roses and sunsets and things like that. When did you start writing? And when you first started writing, were you a young woman? Were you like in high school? Were you and were you writing pretty poems at the time?
Well, I started writing in high school, and I really actually did write kind of pretty poems. Or poems about sunsets. And I think it's because I felt like in art I could really express myself. And then it wasn't really until college and taking poetry writing classes that I learned that it wasn't really about writing about experience, but really just playing with language.
And also your identity as a Korean adoptee, I'm wondering how that might have fit in with your development as a poet and the evolution of your subject.
It's definitely a subject that was harder to write about because it's so emotional. And after I went to Korea, which is about 4 years ago, I kind of romanticized a lot of things about Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So I think going there and seeing the country and not exactly being accepted there and being a foreigner made me rethink identity.
Yeah, it's like a Chicano going to Mexico for the first time. They realize they're not Mexicans.
It's true. It's sort of I think describing being bicultural, I think it sounds theoretically nice, but I think that like interiorly it doesn't always feel the same way.
And I imagine also as you develop your identity as a Korean adoptee that you're also simultaneously developing a perspective, a more developed perspective on race and class, and that these two may have begun to influence the way the language unfolds in your poetry.
Yeah, I think that's it's definitely a question that I think maybe easier tackled in prose writing than poetry. I think racial questions is always like something that's always changing for me. I mean, as an adoptee, I think that I grew up with Anglo parents and a family in a pretty Caucasian town. So I didn't really know what it was like to be Asian American. I didn't even know that was a term.
When was that you started to develop the identity? Was that in college at the university?
No, you know, I think it was much later, like in grad school. Mm. And really since I've been in Los Angeles, it's the first place I've lived where I've been in such a diverse place. I think it's always sort of this process of change.
When I was reading the book, something that really caught my attention is the artwork. Can you tell me a little bit about why you chose that art and how it relates to your poetry?
Sure. The artist is Jung Young Min, and she's a Korean painter. She's surrealist. The cover, I really like that she incorporates sort of a lot of animals in her work. She lives in France. And the different paintings that are put in between the etchings, they're abstract. And actually, my editor, I think, kind of chose some of these paintings inside. And they get more explosive as the sections go on. I don't know, I think I was just drawn to her work because of the kind of texture and just kind of an unusual look to her work.
In your bio, it says that you collaborate on avant-garde music and art projects with composers and visual artists. What kind of work is that that you do?
Well, right now I'm working with a painter, and she's doing different works based on photographs in Cape Cod right now. We don't actually work together because we're geographically apart.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just been working on different poems and kinds of ideas of empty spaces and sort of hauntings. So I think for me, it's like the visual part is, I try to connect what I see in the visual part and then with the words is really separate. So with that collaboration, I feel like it's kind of more about trying to fill in with the, there's no humans in any of her paintings.
Mm.
I'm trying to kind of think about different stories of what along with the empty houses that she's creating.
Your language in this book, you know, is very beautiful, very smooth. The poems are very... they're nice to listen to, but they're very visual. There's not a lot of abstractions in this book at all. That difference between your attraction to abstract art and to avant-garde art and your poems, which tend to be very, I guess you can even say narrative, visual. Have you ever tried or do you ever want to write poems that are a little bit more languagey and less rooted or...
My second book is more language-driven, so I'm trying to work more in different fragments, different prose poems, kind of like when Claudia Rankine plays off of Gertrude Stein's prose poems, where they're really associative. In the process of sort of writing this book, there are so many poems that got cut out that I think maybe were a little bit more avant-garde-y or a little bit more fragmented. So the book itself, I feel like, reads kind of more polished. It may be like, a lot more of my poems are. But I think there is something to be gained with a non-narrative poem.
Right.
I'm more drawn to them, even though, you know, I don't really write them like that.
I always like to ask poets, what is your writing process like? Do you usually get an image in your head and you work from that? Or do you get a theme? Or how is it that these poems come to you?
I think a lot of different ways, like especially if I've been thinking about a film, or I was just reading like Jericho Brown's book and thinking about sort of the music that he was writing about, the different musicians. Sometimes I feel like it's just sort of an unconscious line or a melody or something that comes in. But right now I'm kind of trying to work on series of poems to kind of organize like all the different types of poems that I'm working on. I think for me, it's just sort of, it kind of depends on where I am in my life right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, I can relate to that.
Well, it's a lovely book, Magnetic Refrain by Nikki Saun Schildkraut. Nikki, we have a segment that we call Poem of the Week. So I wonder if you'd be willing to read one of your poems from this book.
Sure, it would be lovely. I think I'll just read this shorter one, the Family History, which is in my first section. It's called Family History. They took turns becoming invisible. Their mother broke the scale, blaming the weight of grief, and kept eating. Their brothers disappeared in a fog of gorillas, and only one returned home, at once forgetting everyone's name. It was the middle of a civil war no one could remember. Older soldiers warned them that nothing was new, that everything was recurring, like old wives' tales. Ghosts returned as animals to teach them how to be inhuman. Women were pots of gold or salt, traded between old and young men, who still believed rainbows came only after rain. They took turns telling stories, since the rest of their family was silent, and sometimes a relative appeared abruptly, like fog, to tell them what they'd dreamt, what still haunted them, though they were no longer living ordinary lives. They longed for extraordinary revenge, happiness with sorrow, love that could be measured by a scale or by color. They longed to become visible again.
That was Nikki Saun Schildkraut reading from her book, Magnetic Refrain. Thank you so much, Nikki, for joining us for Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Danielle and Nancy.
Thank you.
Cheryl Luna earned a PhD in contemporary literature from the University of North Texas and an MFA from right here at the University of Texas, El Paso. Her first collection, Pity the Drowned Horses, received the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize and was published by the University of Notre Dame Press. It was a finalist for the National Poetry Series and the Colorado Book Award. This is her second book called Seven, which we're going to talk about today, and it was published 2013 by Three, a Taos Press. Cheryl Luna, welcome to Words on a Wire.
So Cheryl, tell me about the gestation of this book.
Well, it took me about 7 years to write, almost 8 years when you consider the editing.
So Pity the Drowned Horses came out 7 years ago?
I believe 8 years ago.
8 years ago. And then had you already started on this one?
Yeah, towards the end I had started on it, but I found it a difficult book to write, so it took me some time.
Why difficult?
Well, I was dealing with the issues of trauma and recovery, and I think that it took me time in my personal life to resolve certain things. So I think that's one reason it took so long to write.
This book called Seven is split up into seven parts, each of them named after one of the seven deadly sins. At what point in the process of putting this book together did you realize it was going to be organized that way, or did you always know?
I didn't always know. I had written a large number of poems, and as I looked over them for many years, I discovered that there were certain themes, certain emotional themes like anger, sloth, laziness. Those seven sins were emerging from the poems I had. I had originally divided into seven sections and then started noticing the emotions coming out, and so I thought that would be a good way to divide the book.
Why the seven deadly sins? What does it mean to you? What does it mean to this book?
Well, I think the thing that I felt is that the seven deadly sins, it's also about the seven virtues or the seven charities. And I think that they're closely aligned, and that you know, how they say there's a fine line between love and hate. I think the same is true for many of these sins and virtues, and that sometimes an apparent sin can be a virtue, for instance.
You say that these themes were emerging as you wrote, but then all of a sudden, at some point, you decided that you had a book, and then did you write poems toward that book and create poems for the book?
I did, especially towards the end. I was working with an editor. Her name is Andrea Watson, out of Three, a Taos Press. And she just kept saying, well, do you have any more poems? And I did. I was writing at the time, and so we kept adding poems to what we had and expanding on that. So I would say, yes, I did write some of the poems after I had gotten the idea.
And so do you write poetry full-time?
Well, I don't have a day job right now. I'm volunteering for the Jefferson Center for Mental Health to teach creative writing, and I'm finding it very fun. It's very interesting, and it's very different than teaching at an academic institution.
I'm sure you have an equal amount of anxiety coming from the writers, though.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You know, Cheryl, years ago, when I first started at University of Texas, El Paso, in the MFA program, you were a student here. You had already had your PhD, I believe, and I think you might have even had an MFA from another university. But you were here studying in your hometown in El Paso, and you were, at that point, were you working on Pity the Drowned Horses? Which was the very first winner of the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. And it's a lovely book. I've taught it in class, and it's a lovely cover art by Malaquias Montoya. This one, Seven, has a really interesting cover art. It's a woman in a white dress and a white mask, and she's kind of in a very interesting position, as if she's just been struck by the Holy Spirit, or struck by God, or struck by sin. You can't really tell. Where did this image come from?
It's from an artist named Brooke Shaden. Basically, this poet named Veronica Golos, I think that's how you pronounce her name, had suggested this particular artist. And I was looking at a number of artists, and I I felt the book sort of represented what I was experiencing as I wrote the book, and that it was a good image for basically trauma and wearing masks.
I noticed as I was thumbing through your book, when I first picked it up, that you thanked Ben and I in the acknowledgement. Thank you very much for thinking of us.
Oh, yes, definitely.
But I am your Facebook friend, glad to be. And I notice you're doing painting now, and you're getting really good at it. What effect does it have on your poetry? What effect does it have on you? How are you finding it to fit into your life, your artistic life?
Well, I'm definitely a beginner, but I think it helps my creativity, you know, just using different colors, and it's very soothing to paint. I find it very relaxing, and that sort of sets me up for writing.
What happens to you when you write a poem as opposed to what's happening to you when you're working on a painting?
Well, basically, when I'm working on a painting, it's more visual, obviously, and I enjoy the... they're both similar in the sense that you create something out of nothing. Sort of you're creating form out of formlessness, and that's a very exciting process for me.
We're talking to Cheryl Luna. Her latest book is entitled Seven. It's a book of poems. Cheryl, we always have our guests, if they're poets, to read a poem of the week. So Daniel and I were wondering if you could read the poem Seven for our
sure.
poem of the week.
Seven. Martes a party. Lunes, a tide pulling you dark. Miércoles, a miracle. Viernes, sounding old. Viejita, her forlorn wisdom wanders like a ghost. Thursday, full of thirst. Friday, a pit roast. Sábado, sexy. Sombrero, a Sabbath. Domingo, as host. How many times should we forgive? Prime number, 7 times 7. Jacob's 7-year service to Rachel turned to love. Once, 7 spheres in space coiled heaven. Mercury is a hot burn close to the firelight that's us. Venus holds a lusty lease on the sun. Who can forgive trespasses, slick, feigned love? Mars, a red desert, and Saturn reigned in dust. Uranus, planet of philanthropy, prone to distrust. Moses, bewildered and naked, pale, in the wilderness, heard the Alpha, the Omega burn, his synapses ablaze. In the beginning was the Word, the universe, a wordless hum of dust and light. Cold emptiness, stars like lamps, named for mythical heroes. Orion, with his war shield seen for centuries clutching a sword. We learned to kill early and kill well. Wisdom's house built on 7 columns, and there are 7 deadly sins and 7 virtues. It is said God formed everything in 7 days, and our days and nights but a cast stone sparked.
Thank you, Cheryl. That was lovely. And thank you for being our guest today on Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you so much for speaking with me. I'm honored.
This is Benjamin Alita Science for Words on a Wire. I continue a series of poetic licenses with musings on words, language, memory. The first word I fell in love with was ephemeral. I found the word in Saint-Exupéry's The Little Prince. The word fascinated me. I remember looking the word up in the library. The word came from the Greek and it meant literally, lasting for only one day. Brief. I wondered why, in the list of synonyms, the word mortality did not appear. I had heard several times that our lives on earth were brief. I put those two words together in my mind. And from then on, I became fascinated with all the words in the world and how you could put them together and make something that had never been made before. I came to the realization that when we spoke a word, well, that was the most ephemeral of things. When I spoke a word, it was gone almost as soon as the word left my lips. The word was gone in less than a second, and only the memory of it remained. And so it occurred to me that memory was necessary for words and language to exist. Words and memory were necessary partners. The thought occurred to me just now that when Diego de Landa, the Spanish Franciscan friar, who accompanied the Spanish conquerors, burned the Mayan codices, he deprived future generations of the way the Mayans used their language, and the world forgot. He stole their words in hopes we would not remember a culture he considered barbaric. I wonder how many words, how many languages our violence has made extinct. When I discovered the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, I was more than a little angry that none of my teachers in high school had informed me of its existence. I could have spent my entire high school career studying that book because it told me where all the words came from, how and where they were born. Instead, I had to settle for reading books unsuitable for young people. Moby Dick, which begins with two men in bed, and The Scarlet Letter, which is about adultery, hypocrisy, and a child bastard born out of wedlock. We were also forced to read Macbeth, which was about witchcraft, murder, greed, and ambition. I never really quite understood the logic of my teacher when she confiscated a book I was reading in the back of the room as she lectured. The book was The Exorcist. She said it was not suitable for a young mind. She said that the book should be banned. I wanted to tell her that perhaps The Scarlet Letter should be banned. I'm glad I didn't say it. I wouldn't have meant it. By then, I was too in love with words, not just with stories, but with words. I would sit in class and write down words I knew. It was a list of words that were mine. I had pages and pages of words. And I would wonder, if I look up a word in the dictionary and learn its meaning, is it really mine? Well, I didn't think this was a simple matter because I felt that a word had to live inside you for a while until it became truly yours. Words. Memory. The OED. Where words come from. Another word I love and hate. Faggot. Perhaps I'm obsessed with the word because I'm gay. A faggot is a twig you use to start a fire. Hence a cigarette, which resembles a twig. You start a fire with a twig. That is what we did to homosexual men. We burned them. Faggot. That word has existed for a long time in the English language. It is part of our history. It is part of our historical memory. The word reveals our hatred. The words in our cultural lexicon will always betray our claims to civility. This is Benjamin Alida Sainz for Words on a Wire.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of Words on a Wire. Thank you again, Nancy, for being on the show with me.
No, it's such an honor to be here.
Join us next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. And don't forget,
the next book you read
may save your life. I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.